Hall & Wilcox acknowledges the traditional custodians of the lands on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to all First Nations people joining us today.
Welcome back to another episode of Tax Records. I'm Bradley White, a lawyer here in the Hall & Wilcox tax team. And today we have a very topical podcast in store. We'll be talking about all things cybersecurity. And more specifically, we'll be looking to gain more of an understanding as to why cybersecurity is such a big issue today. We'll be discussing how the regulatory landscape is changing, considering how the current regulatory framework around cybersecurity and data privacy impacts accountants and other tax practitioners and professionals specifically. And we'll also be looking to understand what some more practical steps are that can be undertaken to minimize the risk that, you know, our firm's names end up in as being in the headlines next. So on that note, it is my pleasure to introduce Hall & Wilcox partner, Eden Winokur. A full CV for Eden will be attached on our website along with this podcast. But just briefly, Eden is based out of our Sydney office and is a leading cyber, privacy, disputes and insurance lawyer. Eden is the head of cyber at Hall & Wilcox, which means that he also has one of the coolest sounding titles of any partner at the firm. And Eden really is the go-to person in this space and was recognized as the cyber partner of the year this year by Lawyers Weekly. And is trusted by his clients to not just advise them of their relevant obligations and risks, but also is able to, in the event of a worst case scenario, really get in the trenches with his clients and provide critical advice in response to a breach or potential breach. So welcome, Eden.
Thanks so much, Brad. It's very kind words.
Well, no, they're all well deserved. So I guess let's to kick us off, Eden, could you tell us a bit more about the type of work that you do and I guess what it involves?
Absolutely. So the way I think about my practice is really in two parts. One part is dealing with responsive work. So something's gone wrong. A company's had a cyber attack. We need to respond. Or money's gone missing. Or fraud's been committed against the company, we need to help them respond to a letter of demand, or you know, big insurance claims come in and the insurer needs assistance with understanding what might be covered under the policy, you know, based on the cyber attack and the costs of being incurred. So responding to an incident, that probably makes up about 80% of what I do. The other 20% is, I call it proactive work. That's really helping pre-incident. So companies who may have a cyber incident response plan, but it needs to be updated. We help with that. Or maybe a client needs a response plan started from scratch. We'll help with that. Another thing that I think is quite popular is cyber attack simulation training. So, you know, client sits down, key decision makers are brought in, and you spend sort of a half day simulating an actual cyber attack, sort of a tabletop exercise. And you go through the key decisions that need to be made and, you know, really explain what actually happens during a cyber incident so that the business can get an understanding and practice for how they would respond. And, you know, my experience is that businesses who do that kind of training are usually better placed than those who haven't done it before in responding to an attack. And that can, you know, have a material impact on the severity and impact that a breach might have on a business.
It makes practical sense to kind of undertake that as well. I mean, you know, you have fire drills for a reason. Why not do the same, I guess, for new cybersecurity practices, right?
That's exactly right. It's that kind of training. And many businesses are familiar with, you know, physical training, you know, things around business continuity. That's not a new idea at all. It's that's been around for a lot longer than I have. But now taking those learnings and applying it to the digital world, you know, and really sort of following the things that we know work well, and then you know, transforming that into the cyber approach.
And you mentioned that, I guess, there's an 80-20% split with your work between the reactive and proactive. Are you starting to see a shift in that more towards people being more proactive now? It's kind of more front of mind, these issues, or is it kind of still people are taking a while to catch on? What do you think?
It's a great question. I'd say it goes in ebbs and flows. You know, I think It really sort of depends on what's happening. I think if you look at where we're at now as a country compared to, say, 3 years ago, the country and many businesses around it are far better placed when it comes to having proactive measures in place. Is there more work to be done? Definitely. A lot of companies could do a lot more to be better prepared. One of the issues that I talk a lot about is data retention. Are we hoarding too much data? Can we delete data that we don't lo no longer need, or can we take certain information and then store it offline so that if a hacker gets in and tries to steal your data, a lot of it is not going to be impacted, or do you need it at all anyway? Can you get rid of it? And so, I think sort of data is the new oil was a phrase that started being used, in the early 2000s, and in a way, it is. It provides very rich commercial information, but it comes with a lot of risks, and there are legal obligations in Australia around that. What I'd also say is, in the last couple of weeks, there's been an announcement by the government that there'll be major reforms to the Privacy Act. I think we're going to talk about that, and that's going, I think, to lead to a big surge of proactive work because businesses are going to now need to get some advice on regulatory compliance with the new privacy laws. And so I'm anticipating an uptick in that kind of work. And then, with response work, often a lot of the attacks are coming from Europe. Often a lot of the attacks are coming from businesses, and I'm calling the criminals businesses because that's really how they operate. But groups operating out of countries where, let's just say, Australia is not very friendly with them on a diplomatic level, at a diplomatic level. And it's July was a quiet month for attacks because the view was a lot of the criminals are out enjoying the European summer. But August and September, have been. We've seen a major increase in attacks, and so a lot of the work has been coming in through that response side of the practice.
Okay, so if you're going to take a holiday, best for you to also align yours with the European summer, it sounds like.
A good idea.
Well, I guess so. So obviously, we've touched on that cybersecurity and data privacy are major issues in the current commercial environment. And like you kind of mentioned, we're seeing an uptick recently. And I guess from me, more of an outside perspective, it seems like there's a new like bad news story, about some company being a victim of a new cyber attack or breach almost, weekly. So I guess could you talk a little bit about, how these kinds of breaches arise and I guess what some of the causes are?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm working on a number of those types of matters at the moment, and the main risk, according to the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, which is sort of Australia's cyber defence group, which sits within the Signals Directorate and the Department of Defence. The major risk is ransomware, and ransomware is really the idea of criminals getting into your network. The major way they do that is through phishing. That's sort of the leading way, or exploiting software vulnerabilities is another way. So you've got to patch your stuff. It's like the Apple updates. You've got to update your Apple software. The reason is someone's found, not always, but sometimes there's a security vulnerability and it's just there's a coding error that can be exploited and needs to be fixed, patched. If you've got a leaking house, you patch it. It's the same concept there, but and then phishing, people give over their credentials, your username and password, and then the criminals can log in. And that's why it's really important to have multi-factor authentication. But then even now, the criminals play in this game of cat and mouse. So as we come up with a good defense, they figure out a way around it. And so right now, one of the hot topics is how to bypass MFA. And so we've got to be really vigilant in not only having MFA, but making sure it's good MFA and really taking a high degree of care in when we click on links or when we provide our usernames and passwords, really being careful and not just sort of mindlessly doing it because that's how the attacks are starting. Coming back to ransomware, once a criminal gets in through some of the means I've just mentioned, what they are doing is they are more often than not now looking to see what information you've got. And they might spend weeks and weeks doing this. And so it's a pretty good idea to get some monitoring on and sort of, you know, speaking in layman's terms, you know, the way that you can think about your monitoring is, you know, if you were trying to protect your house with security and think about your networks as a house, what would you want? You'd want to have some alarm bells that go off if someone breaks in. You'd also, if they do manage to get in and they, you know, somehow disable the alarm, then you want to have CCTV footage. And where would you want to have that? You want to have it in every room. And you wouldn't want it to be grainy. You'd want it to be really clear and high definition. And it'd be even better if you could get sound. So the way that technology works is that you can put in place that kind of security over your network, but people don't really talk about it in that way very often. And so I find it easy because I'm a lawyer, not an IT expert. So I sort of have tried to describe it in a way that really sort of makes sense to me. But technologically, you're able to do all of those things. And so most businesses don't have that level of security. Criminals are getting in. They spend weeks in there. They start figuring out what data they want to take because they've become sort of like an administrator. They quickly get in and elevate their privileges so that they're all almost like your IT manager, so they can do whatever they like and set up accounts and change passwords and get access to everything. And then they will stage the data, which means they collate the data. They will steal the data, and then for good measure, they'll lock it all up with encryption. And the only way that you can unencrypt it, if you don't have good backups, is you have to pay a ransom. And now that they've stolen your data, rather than just saying, oh, pay the ransom, or we won't give you the decryption key, they'll say, if you don't pay, we're also going to publish all of your data. That this ransomware, I'm calling it a ransomware epidemic because it's just prevalent at the moment. You know, I was working on 8 different ransomware matters that came in a month period, sort of post European holidays, and they're just happening all the time. There's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these happening to Australian businesses every year, if not more. So that's the major threat. That's really the major threat. There's other things like hacking into emails and trying to commit invoicing fraud, or some criminals will just get in and steal data, like we saw with Optus, for example. But ransomware to me is the major risk, the one that costs the most. It's the one that costs the most, both in terms of responding to it, reputational risk, and to me it's the number one threat.
I guess that is the other flip side to it as well, right? It's not just the dollars, like you mentioned, the reputational risk as well that some of these organizations face when they're on the pointy end of one of these attacks can be disastrous. And I guess this podcast is targeted at tax professionals and tax advisors, both of whom collect a lot of confidential information regarding their clients. You know, we've got financial information, tax file numbers. I guess, can you talk to some of the risks that these practitioners specifically and their firms may need to consider if they are the subject of a cyber breach?
Yeah, absolutely. I've acted for, I don't want to use the word countless because I'm sure if I actually went and spent enough time, I could figure out the number. But I've worked for a significant number of tax practitioners or accountants responding to cyber breaches, a significant amount. I've had hundreds of matters which have involved the exfiltration or unauthorized access or unauthorized disclosure of tax file numbers, like literally hundreds. And it's a significant risk. Like when you get a matter and it's an accountant and there's a data breach or a ransomware matter, you know, the first thing you think is, oh, TFNs. And tax file numbers, as the listeners of this podcast will know, are given special protections. They're very important numbers. They don't change, sort of like a date of birth, I guess, but even more important because date of birth is far more limited what you can do with that. I mean, I've heard anecdotally, not just through my work experience, but also from people I know, of criminals manipulating people's ATO records and misdirecting tax refunds. And finding out that tax refunds have been siphoned off to criminals and the money's gone. And often it's too late when that happens. So that is a real risk. Once a TFN comes in, it's a risk in terms of what happens when we get involved in a matter where they're a TFN's impacted. And again, sort of looking at who the listeners are, if you have an incident, it's highly likely that, potentially many TFNs are going to be impacted. Well, you're immediately looking at a notification to the Privacy Commissioner. Once you do that, you're also required to notify the individuals whose personal information has been the subject of unauthorized access. So let's say hypothetically someone gets into one of your, someone listening, a hacker gets into your mailbox, they can sync that whole mailbox, which means they can download a copy of that to their own computer and have a copy
Nice.
of it just sitting there. And so if you get tax file numbers in emails or you send out tax returns or things of that nature, they can just go through those emails and start picking out payment summaries, tax returns, you name it, and starting to build profiles of your clients to then try and commit fraud against them and steal their money, their refunds, or use it to build other profiles to try and take out new identities or apply for credit. I mean, people are getting driver's licenses created, but by criminals who are, it's not the person,
Right.
and this stuff is prevalent right now. I mean, if you watch A Current Affair for a week, there'll be a story about this at the moment. It's unfortunately happening all the time.
You
And
mentioned
so,
the obligations there to notify the individuals of the breach. I guess is that being able to make sure you know who and what the extent of the breach is. I guess that ties into your earlier point as well around having. To put it non-technically as well, the CCTV capability set up on your own systems to make sure you know what's being accessed and what they've seen to understand the extent of the breach.
you're absolutely spot on. One point to make before I comment on that is, when you think about the reputational harm of having to write to everyone, and then if you've got clients who are no longer with you, and you can't actually contact them to tell them what the risk is, the obligation is to put something up on your website,
Nice.
and then advertise it as well. So there can be massive reputational damage if you have an incident and you have to then go and tell everyone. Then not only that, you've also coming to sort of your question about the CCTV footage. Very often when we're working on these matters, we'll get evidence that there's been some form of syncing, which I was just talking about. The problem is that more often than not, based on the level of CCTV, using that sort of phrase, we're not actually able to tell the extent of the sync. We're not actually able to tell whether it was a single email or all emails that were copied over, because we don't have proper logging that's going on. And unfortunately, the privacy regulator will say that if you're not able to rule out that it was all copied, but you can see that there's evidence in the logs that something was copied and it could have been all of it, the privacy regulator is going to expect that you assume everything was copied. And so, having the right level of logging can be the difference between having to write to one customer about something or having to write to your entire client base. It could be hundreds or thousands of people. So it can have a material impact on how severe an incident can be. The other thing I wanted to mention in response to this question is, what can you do if you have all of your clients' tax file numbers impacted? Well, one thing that, when you have to respond to the Privacy Commissioner or individuals, you're supposed to rec well, you have to recommend steps that an individual can take to mitigate their risk of harm. And the classic sort of thing that you do with TFNs is you recommend the individual contact the ATO client support service. And what you're doing there is you're talking about what protections can be put on TFNs. And your listeners will know way better than I do the pain that you go through when you've got these extra security layers on TFNs, where you literally have to call the ATO every single time you want to put in a return, or every time you want to log into the ATO portal on MyGov, you've got to call the ATO. So, having to tell a couple hundred clients to do that, or you as a practitioner having to call the ATO every single time you want to lodge a return for any client of yours, again, your listeners will know better than I do what kind of pain that would
You'd get very
involve.
familiar with the whole music. Now that I guess we've spoken about the current state of play, and what people need to watch out for. You did mention earlier that there are some changes or recommend changes coming in the pipeline. I guess could you talk more about some of these changes and I guess, why they've been pushed forward? I know this, technology in general, the tech field advances so quickly, and I guess from my side of things in the tax world, we see, some clear deficiencies there in the law where it hasn't quite caught up. Where we've got, for instance, there's still a bunch of question marks around how to deal with crypto that haven't really been covered off. This is it the same in the cyberspace, or do you think these recommendations are going to kind of plug some of those holes if there are any? What are your thoughts?
The major regulatory change on the horizon is Privacy Act reform, and this has been being talked about on both sides of politics for a number of years, and it culminated earlier this year in a report from the Attorney General in February 2023, which proposed 116 changes to the Privacy Act. Really, the intention is to modernize our Privacy Act, which was first written in 1988 just for government agencies, and then it wasn't until years later that it sort of was amended to make it apply to private businesses. And it still doesn't apply to employee records. It still doesn't typically apply to small businesses with revenue under $3 million. These reforms were very carefully considered for a number of years. Report gets issued. There was an invitation for submissions, which were put in until the end of March earlier the year. And the government has now reported, as of the last 2 weeks, and we're recording this on the 6th of October. The government's reported in the last 2 weeks that they've looked at the proposed 116 changes, they've considered the feedback, and they've either agreed or agreed in principle with 106 of the 116 proposed amendments. So we're expecting what I would think is the most sweeping amendment to the Privacy Act that we might see in our lifetime to find its way into a bill that will come out in the next few months. Whether it's before the end of the year or early next year, I'm not sure. But we are expecting, as I said, what I think will be the biggest changes to the Privacy Act in our lifetime. It's going to impact the way that we all do business. I think one of the things I just want to point to is, or two of the things I'll mention. One is sort of notifiable breaches. So currently, if you have an incident, once you first suspect you might be dealing with one, under the current law, you have 30 days to conduct an assessment. And that has to be done reasonably and expeditiously. You've got 30 days to figure out when to notify. The amendment would mean you'd have 72 hours to determine whether to notify, and that would align Australia with various other jurisdictions, including Europe, who has something called GDPR, which is sort of considered the gold standard of one of the gold standards of sort of privacy regimes that was implemented years ago in Europe. So we would be shifting to that 72-hour regime, which would mean significant urgent attention. I mean, it's already urgent, when you're dealing with cyber stuff, but even more urgency. So people need to be prepared for that, because if there's a 72-hour reporting regime, it just shows how important it will be to have a system in place if an incident occurs. Like, who do you call if you have an incident? We run a hotline, a 70 24-hour hotline that's available every day of the year. That's that we have a number of different lawyers working on, and so if we're contacted, someone will jump on it. But do people have a number to call if they have an incident? The other thing I wanted to mention is that under the current privacy law, if you have a serious and/or repeated breach, the penalties can go up to 50 million or even higher, potentially, where there's a 30% of revenue for at least 12 months as a potential maximum penalty, which is enormous. But and it's never been used. but that's for serious and or repeated breaches. The amendments are proposing to bring in mid-tier and lower-tier penalties that can be levied by the Privacy Commissioner. So, right now, unless you're, a major business like a Facebook, the privacy regulator hasn't really focused their attention from a penalties perspective. Some of these major breaches in the last 12 months are being looked at, but really, unless you're one of those major businesses, the government hasn't really focused on enforcement. With these changes, they're looking at introducing mid-tier, which removes the requirement that a breach be serious, which would open up a lot more businesses to risk. And they're also talking about introducing lower tier infringement notices. So it's bad enough when you get a $120 penalty for overstaying your 1 hour in a parking meter type of infringement notice. We're talking about infringement notices potentially up to say $63,000, which is not a small thing for a lot
No.
of businesses. And you have a little cyber incident, and the next thing you're getting clipped with a $20,000 penalty. Like
Yeah.
that stings. And so that is going to be a pretty good cause for businesses to get on top of these issues. And really, I think privacy is going to become a major factor for businesses over the next 5 to 10 years.
And you mentioned before that, under the current regime, I believe you said small businesses are generally ordinarily exempt. It sounds like the main thrust of a lot of these changes is casting a wider net. Is that something that's recommended to change as well?
Yeah,
Okay.
that's it. That's a great question as well. Yes, the one of the proposals is to actually remove entirely the small business exemption. So all of a sudden, Privacy Act will apply to everyone. I think a number of people listening, even if you're a small business, if you are a tax file recipient, i.e., a tax pro, someone who works in tax, that exemption doesn't apply to you. So,
Okay.
yeah, so I think a number of these listeners will already be caught up, but it does sort of raise questions where if you're a tax recipient and a small business and you have a little incident that doesn't involve any tax file numbers, maybe right now things are okay, but moving forward that could change.
Yeah, or even, this sounds like it might impact a lot of people's clients as well in that space, potentially. So
Absolutely.
I guess now that everyone's appropriately alert or scared, and fear can be a great motivator, I guess what are some of the practical things that we can do in the meantime to try and manage these risks that we've gone through today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you're spot on. You're spot on about sort of doom and gloom, and sometimes I'm a fairly positive person, and people tell me I smile a lot, but I'm always talking about doom and gloom. What can you do to fix it? Well, some of the things we've talked about some of the things that people can do, we've already touched on. And to me, the key thing is to understand that, with cyber risk, it is really important and it is really significant. And when things go wrong, they can go really wrong. But there is a lot that we can do to majorly reduce the risk of it happening. And you just don't want to be an easy target. And if you, it's sort of that thing, if you're in the water with a shark, you just don't want to be the slowest swimmer. Put in place, you can put in place things that will give you flippers, that will give you, motorized water vehicle to hopefully get away. Now, there's nothing you can do to reduce your cyber risk to zero. There is nothing that can be done to reduce your cyber risk to zero. And so what that means is we should all be trying to maximize or get as close to zero as possible, and we should all be prepared for an incident to happen. So that's the way I think of it. Like the best thing anyone can do is to be prepared for an incident. And so that is doing that sort of upfront preparation, having plans, training for this stuff, so that if a fire goes off, everyone knows where the fire stairs are. What does that look like? Well, CCTV is a great way to do it. So get logs, like, and keep them for long enough, and speak to your IT professional and use this analogy and tell them or ask them what is it to have CCTV footage, and what is it to have good HD CCTV and sound? Like, what does that actually look like technologically? How much does that cost? What do we need to do? A great example is with Microsoft. They have different levels of packages that you can get, and the more you pay, And it does get expensive. I'm not, it's really a business decision about how much people want to pay for this stuff. There's a lot that you can get just, with Microsoft packages. And so, really, it's a question to your IT provider, internally and externally, depending on what business you are, about what you can do when it comes to logs. That's one thing. Second thing is, where are you from a security perspective? Like, ask that question as a business. I'm a lawyer. I'm not the right person to ask that question. I mean, I will ask that question as a lawyer within our business because I'm interested and I recommend it to others. And so try to practice what I preach. But, how do we stack up against sort of acceptable standards? So unfortunately, unlike tax and law, where there is sort of a standard and we have guidelines and we have registrations as professionals, in the IT world, that doesn't exist. So, you'll get a huge range of quality when it comes to your IT professionals. So, how do you know if you've got a good one? Pretty hard to tell unless you know a thing or two about IT. So, what you can do though is you can go to the government puts out a lot of good information through cyber.gov.au. One of the things they talk about is it's that Australian Cybersecurity Centre, the ACSC, they have something called the Essential Eight, which are eight key controls that they recommend that all businesses have in place. Now, a lot of them are really easy, like MFA is one of them, really easy to implement, or should be easy enough to implement. Some of them are a bit more challenging. But, a good question could be go and speak to your IT vendor and say, how are we against the Essential Eight? And do a bit of reading on it and actually understand what these things are and then go and question. It's sort of, I think we're at a point now where just relying entirely on others and sort of putting our own heads in the sand is a risky approach and not one that I would recommend. So there are two things, sort of look at standards, get your logging sorted, get your sort of CCTV. Another one is data retention. I mentioned that earlier. Actually stop and think, what do we have on our systems? Have you got all this old archive stuff that is redundant? Have I got, being a bit morbid here, but have I got clients who have passed away and I don't need to have their details anymore? Things like that. What system do you have in place to actually delete data when you no longer need it? And do you actually need to have everything connected to your active systems, or can you store stuff that's 2 years old on external drives not connected to your system? These are really important issues. Two more points. One is, and I think this is probably the biggest risk that one of the biggest risks that we all face. Who are your third parties? Which parties have your data? Which parties have access to your data? Which parties are able to interact with your systems? Accountants, tax practitioners, are you using MYOB? Are you using Xero? Are you using your own proprietary software? What are you using? What's their security like? Or how helpful are they going to be if you have an incident? Using one of those two names I just mentioned, I know that one of them, I was working with a tax practitioner a couple of months ago, and they found it particularly difficult to get logging information from one of those businesses. So, has anyone even thought about these things? And should you be doing stuff before an incident happens? The answer is yes. Third parties are an incredible risk. The last thing is cyber insurance. So, I strongly recommend, I think everyone should get cyber insurance personally. And really, it's more of a question of, what level of cover is appropriate rather than should you have it. The very least that businesses should be doing is having detailed discussions with their broker about what cyber insurance is, about what it covers, about how much it costs. And just in short, if you have a cyber attack, you need to bring in IT experts, you need lawyers involved. They're two very basic things that cyber insurance covers. The cost of our engagement. We do a lot of work. A lot of the clients I work with are cyber insurers. And so if someone has cyber insurance and you have a claim, then the insurer will recommend to call us and then the insurer will pay our costs. That's an enormously helpful thing if an incident occurs. And so I strongly recommend everyone to either get it or speak to your broker about it.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, so it sounds like a bit of a plan for the worst, and if everything goes all well and smooth, then that's a win. But the risks of putting your head in the sand are astronomical and would not be a recommended approach in any way, shape, or form. Well, I guess that brings an end to my questions. There's a lot there, and I'm sure we could talk about it kind of all day. And cybersecurity really is one of the most business critical issues that are facing organizations today. So Eden, thank you very much for joining us here. I'd also like to thank our listeners. Don't hesitate to get in touch with Eden with any questions that you might have. You can find more information on our website at hallandwilcox.com.au, or you can find Eden on LinkedIn. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and follow on whatever platform that you listen to your podcasts on.
This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.